Welcome to At the Table. I'm Clark Wolf, and this is the weekly radio show about all things food, brought to you from Sonoma County, not just wine country, but farm country. Today, we're talking to a gentleman who probably is the most celebrated chef in America. And I don't mean by that he has the highest ratings on TV. I don't think he's actually ever had a smackdown or a throwdown or a knife fight. We'll ask him about that later. But he has been celebrated for the quality of his work and his dedication with more Beard Foundation Awards, James Beard Award Foundation Awards, and Meryl Streep. Wait a second. I'm not sure how that works. Please welcome to At the Table, Chef Thomas Keller. Welcome, Thomas.
Thank you, Clark. It's quite an introduction. Thank you very much. It's good to be chatting with you here in California.
Yeah, it's good to be in California. Talk to us a little bit about, some people know your history, but it's always good to hear it and not read it from the person who lived it. I mean, I know that you worked with your mom and you ended up cooking almost by mistake, as in the guy didn't show up and you got to cook.
Right.
But tell us that story, but also about, you know, each of the pieces that brought you to the collection of restaurants and efforts that you now work daily to uphold and maintain.
Well, thank you. I'll do my best. I'll give you the cliff notes.
Okay.
I was raised by a single parent. That was my mother. And I'm certainly thankful for everything that she gave me, my work ethic, attention to detail, sense of awareness of things around you. You know, it certainly helped me in many ways in my career. But it was just that. It was the youngest of five boys. My brother Joseph and I, who's the next oldest, would spend, you know, our evenings, doing our homework at the restaurant as opposed to at home, because that's where she was. And we found our way into the kitchen because that's where you could have kind of young boys working.
Right.
And, you know, Joseph was older than I was, so he got to hold the knife, and I got to hold the dishes and wash dishes. So that's kind of where it all began for me. I found really a very comfortable place in the kitchen. I was surrounded by, you know, by food. I was surrounded by people who cared. I was surrounded by people who took care of me, you know, including my mother, of course.
Yep.
But it just seemed to be a really familiar place for me, not to mention it was also warm and kind of
right. You know? And it's probably smelled good.
Yeah. And we got to eat.
And you got to eat. And with your older brother, I mean, that's so interesting that you got to share that with a sibling.
Yeah. He was actually my first mentor, you know, and so, you know, things went on from that point until, you know, I was out of high school, and I was in South Florida at the time with my mother working at the Palm Beach Yacht Club. And, you know, as you pointed out, you know, the chef left, and I was then, you know, given the knife and the reins to cook. I went out and got my best friend, who had no ideas. I had better idea than he did about cooking.
Right.
And Joseph became our mentor. You know, taught us how to make hollandaise sauce, told us how to roast a prime rib, broil a lobster tail, make an omelet. You know, the basic things for this small club, which was basically a lunch place for local businessmen.
Where did Joseph learn these things?
Joseph was across the Intercoastal in Palm Beach at the famed Petite Marmite restaurant.
So
he'd found a love for cooking far before I did. You know, his mentors at the time were, you know, Graham Kerr, the Galloping Gourmet.
Yeah.
I mean, he'd come home after school and watch that on TV. So he really fell in love with cooking at a young age and worked at the Petite Marmite, you know, as a young cook, and learned, of course, a lot of the fundamental basic skills of French cookery, and was able to pass those on to me. You know, fast forward, you know, I ended up in Narragansett, Rhode Island in 1977, being the staff cook, or the family cook, as I like to say, for a private club there, a beach club called the Dunes Club in Narragansett, and the chef was Roland Hennen. And up until that time, you know, cooking for me was about travel, was about teamwork, was about that camaraderie, was about that, you know, sense of urgency, you know, the stress, the success, the, you know, all of that stuff that goes on in a kitchen nightly when you're online with, you know, four or five other guys, you know,
right,
in this very intense kind of kitchen.
Right.
The Dunes Club was my first place where I worked only during the day and only cooked dinner for a select group of people. So it was very interesting to do that. And Roland, my mentor, you know, expressed to me the reason that cooks cook, and we cook to nurture people.
Yeah.
And that nurturing aspect really resonated with me, and that was the point in 1977, July actually, when I decided to become a professional chef. And, you know, from then on, it was just focusing on French cuisine, because I realized that if I wanted to be the best, you know, and at the time, you know, French cuisine was the most celebrated, the most refined, you know, certainly got the most attention. And I worked for a French chef, so what better place to start than at the very top?
Yeah, and you had learned, I mean, the idea that an older brother would pass down how to make sauce, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I got a couple of sweatshirts. You know what I mean? No, but that sets up a kind of, I mean, what's wonderful is that you've always, and I'm stopping to talk about this because
sure.
It's so interesting. You're known so strongly in the industry as a leader, but so much of what you're talking about has to do with accepting guidance from someone who went before.
Mentorship is so important.
I mean, it's good for people to understand that we're talking to Thomas Keller, Chef mm-hmm. Thomas Keller, who is really probably the most celebrated chef in America, certainly American chef, and we'll talk about that and why later on. But so you're now getting the French bug, I guess you could say.
Of course, yeah. I mean, you know, French was it, you know, so off I went, you know, traveling around the country, ending up in Catskill, New York for 3 summers for a wonderful restaurant there called La Rive with two beautiful people, Renee and Paulette McCary, who ran the restaurant. And I would go back in the wintertime, I'd go back to Florida and work in a beautiful French restaurant down there called Café de Parc. And then one winter I realized that, you know, I should go to New York City. Ended up at New York City, befriended Serge Raoul from the famed Raoul's restaurant on Prince Street in New York City, and it was time for me to go to France. You know, I really felt that, you know, if I was going to have this complete understanding, not just of French food, but French culture, you know, the social aspect of it, how and why, you know, the French did what they did.
Right.
You know, so with help from a number of different people, including Serge and Roland Hennin, I ended up in France for a year and a half. And it was just, you know, it was just a wonderful experience. It was my, you know, it was my graduate degree. I learned how to cook. I'd been cooking for a good 12 years before that. So I wasn't trying to learn how to saute a piece of fish or cut a steak or things like that. You know, it was really about, you know, what made the great French restaurant great. And, you know, it was really about consistency, you know, and that I realized that pretty early on. You know, there were some really wonderful restaurants that I worked at, you know, which weren't as consistent as you'd hoped them would be, and that's why they only had one star. You know, and then the greatest restaurants of all may not have been doing like the most cutting edge food, but their consistency was spot on every day execution. You know, just a great execution. And I learned that, you know, it's really about that consistency. Yes, you want to be able to continue to develop, continue to evolve your technique, continue to evolve your repertoire and make sure that you're pushing forward and progressing every day. But if you can't be consistent, then you're just not going to make it.
You know, it's so interesting that you say that. I mean, there is this other piece that you have in your restaurants that the French seem to have that came to mind when you talked about Raoul's, because Raoul's is a very special place in my mind. It has magic. It has alchemy.
Yep. Yep.
And I don't think you can literally teach alchemy, but I think you can learn it. I think that when people, one of the reasons, as you say, so many people who love restaurants go to France, go to Italy, come to California, is that there's a certain magic and a certain alchemy that gets developed and gets nurtured and gets embodied in certain places that you can kind of learn how to lean into.
Yep.
Right. I mean, so I used to joke about Raoul's that you better not go there with somebody you're not intending to, shall we say, date, because it's so intensely romantic and visceral.
Yeah.
Right.
It still is. I mean, it's 30 some odd years later, and it still is. I mean, it's you know, it's one of those phenomena in the hospitality profession. You know,
yeah.
In restaurants, it's just great. So that was France, and I came back from France and was able to be chosen as the first American chef to run one of the great La Le restaurants.
I love that. Yeah. The great La Le, or Le La, depending.
The restaurants of New York City, right?
This
was La Reserve. And, you know, Georges Briguet, the famous Georges Briguet from the Perigord, was part owner. Jean-Louis Miseau was the other owner. You know, so you had this very specific, you know, Swiss man who, you know, went by, you know, I mean, he was regimented and so precise. And then you had the Frenchman who was, you know, as precise as Jean-Louis was, you know, he was more French, you know, more spontaneous. And it was a great opportunity for me. But, you know, I came back from France and I was a little bit arrogant, you know, I was a little bit immature. for such a restaurant. And you know, I couldn't seem to understand that it wasn't my restaurant, it was his restaurant.
Right. You know, it's great to see somebody or to hear somebody so successful as yourself to understand that and to say that out loud.
Yeah.
And by the way, folks, so that in case you didn't know, for many years, most of the really top chefs in America were Swiss. And some of them were French and some of them were German. And so for Thomas Keller to become this young American chef at the head of the stove is a big deal. So in our last minute of this segment, tell us how you progressed from New York City, in New York City, to California.
Yes. Well, you know, I finally became partners with Serge at our restaurant Raquel, which, you know, struggled after the 1989 or 1988
crash.
Stock market crash.
Oh, my gosh. You know, it's funny. It was 1987.
But
we all didn't feel it until 1988 and 1989. And I was at that wonderful restaurant, Raquel, and I loved it. The food was kind of shockingly good and up above things that people had seen or experienced in New York from a young American chef.
Yeah, but it was also in one of those neighborhoods which wasn't quite a neighborhood, right?
Yeah. It was a crossroads.
So we missed it. And I ended up in California. I ended up at Checkers Hotel.
Well, we'll get to that in a minute, Chef. We're going to get to California in a minute.
Okay.
As soon as we get back at the table, right here with Chef Thomas Keller. Welcome back to At the Table. We are talking with Chef Thomas Keller from many places, from the French Laundry in Yountville, from Per Se in New York, from Bouchon, a wonderful brasserie in a couple of cities, as well as Bouchon Bakery, and Ad Hoc, which is in Yountville. And we'll talk about that in a minute. But we have joined him across the Eastern Seaboard from Florida and on up to New York. And now we're getting to join him in California, in Los Angeles. It's in a restaurant that was in a very lovely hotel owned by a late friend of mine, Bill Wilkinson, who brought boutique to a particular kind of experience in Los Angeles that hadn't been there before. Thomas, when you got to Checkers Hotel, right across from the Biltmore, the famed kind of overwrought grand, I have to say it was Rococo. And here you were in this very... It wasn't so much that it was modern for its time, but it wasn't modern as in modernistic design. It was clean, it was comfortable, it was luxurious, and it was complete. And you were doing some very, very interesting food. What brought you there, and what did you discover when you got there?
Well, you know, Bill was brilliant. You know, Bill pioneered the boutique hotel, and certainly the you know, the chef of those hotels. I mean, you think of Campton Place in San Francisco. You know, you think of Bradley Ogden.
Yes.
You know, where really kind of it all began, and that was Bill Wilkinson, and you know, he, as you mentioned, you know, just a great pioneer, a great friend, and you know, a great person. What brought me to Los Angeles was just you know, two friends who I'd known in LA, and I'm sorry, who I'd known in New York, who were moving to LA. And you know, knew that I was struggling to find my way after the demise of Raquel, and said, you know, you should come to California. We're moving out to California. You know, come with us. And so, you know, I did. I said, what do I have to lose? I'm single. I don't have a job here. You know, I talked to Bill, and Bill invited me to become part of the Checkers team as the chef de cuisine there. He's the executive chef of the hotel, actually. And I moved to Los Angeles. It was eye opening for me. I used to think that that New York was the center of the universe, and so I got to California and realized that the food here, the raw products, are just extraordinary. I mean, you know, as good as we get in New York, and certainly in the city, you get some really really wonderful products, but nothing like we get here in California. And I'm talking about vegetables for the most part.
Right.
You know, proteins. Yeah, we can get proteins all over the country, but the vegetables that are here are just magnificent, and you know, it's eye-opening. And so moving into Los Angeles and to work for Checkers Hotel was a wonderful opportunity for me to kind of set my foundation back here in California, because I was actually born in Southern California.
Really, where?
Yeah, in Oceanside,
oh,
Camp
right.
Pendleton. My father was a Marine.
Wow.
So as much as I didn't grow up here, I was a native of California, which, you know, really helped me in a great deal being accepted. You know, coming from New York to California.
Yeah, not always good. Not
you know,
so, yeah.
Yeah,
well, and I also, exactly. There's a lot of competition, but
right.
we'll get to this in a minute because there's a lot of competition between Southern California and Northern California.
But when
I remember, that's so funny. Because you have places in Beverly Hills. When you were at Checkers, I remember I was hosting an American Institute of Wine and Food conference on gastronomy at the Biltmore Hotel.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when Ernest and Giulio Gallo first got back to speaking to each other after 80 years or 50 years. You know what I mean? And suddenly all the, in those days, the Cognoscente, the family of food and wine people was pretty small.
Yep.
I used to say it was somewhere between 200 and 2,000 people. And suddenly we had 500 of them across the street from Checkers. And we were having all these conferences and we were having all these meetings and these sessions and all these panels. And everybody kept escaping across the street to go to Checkers to eat your food. You know, they would come back and report on what they had just eaten, whether they were sitting in that wonderful bar room or in the dining room. And the word passed very quickly, but very deeply, with a lot of knowledge, not just an Instagram photograph, right?
Right.
So there you were in Southern California. Now, wait a second. How old were you when you left California? We want to know what benchmarks you had in your mouth.
Oh, I was very young. And I think I was 4 years old when I left California.
Well, then you could have eaten some good produce before you left town. It might have been mashed. All right. So you did Checkers, and you were an instant hit with a lot of people. But a lot of times in L.A., you don't get really successful unless you're someplace where all the stars go,
right.
And they all go to bed at 6 o'clock.
Right.
So
right.
Lunch is a big deal. But I mean, what was it like there, and how did it lead to Northern California?
Well, you know, I mean, Checkers was downtown, so you're right across from the Biltmore, as you mentioned. You know, and we struggled. We struggled for a number of different reasons. Certainly, you know, at this period in Los Angeles, there weren't that many people going downtown. It wasn't the vibrant cultural center that it is today. It didn't have that sense of excitement and rediscovery that it has today. And even worse, they were working on the new public library.
Yes.
Right next to the hotel. So
it was
every
a
morning
mess.
You had these jackhammers, you know, piling in these pilings, and nobody wanted to stay there because at 7:30 in the morning they'd be woken up with this not just noise, but vibration from the new public library. You know, so it was difficult. You know, and again, I finally left about a year and a half after I arrived in L.A. Left Checkers, and again, you know, found myself, you know, with what am I going to do? You know, this big question: where am I going to go? How am I going to achieve any type of success, or will I ever have any success, or should I find something else to do, like go to Fiji and fish?
How old were you at this time?
Let me see. I was. Went to almost 30 years old at this time.
Yeah, that's a time when a lot of chefs say, I've been working at this for a while.
Yeah.
You know, am I going to make it or not? Because, you know, you have another, I don't know, 10, 15 years of being prime physical.
Right.
And you want to get on with it.
Right, right. So, you know, I bummed around L.A. just doing some odd jobs, you know, doing some cooking for private families or private parties or things like that. I started a little olive oil company called Evo, which was semi-successful. We had a great time doing that. It kept me occupied.
Yeah.
In the meantime, you know, I was dating a girl who would travel here to Napa Valley quite often, and I came up one week with her, and we stopped in to see Jonathan Waxman as he was building, at the time, Table 29.
Yes.
And Jonathan told me about this little restaurant in Yountville for sale. He said, you know, you should go up and take a look at it. Well, sure enough, we drove up here. I walked around the property. They were closed that day, so there was nobody here, but I just fell in love with it. You mentioned the word magical.
Yeah.
I'm talking about Rebels. Well, you know, for me, this was just a magical place, and I instantly fell in love with it and contacted Don and Sally Schmidt, who are the current owners, and said, I'd like to buy your restaurant. It was a very short negotiation.
No, wait a second. Had you known that? So they had begun thinking about moving further north and letting go of the restaurant because it's hard work.
Retire.
Yeah,
they'd
it's hard
run
work.
The restaurant for 17 years.
Yeah.
You know, they'd raised their family here, and you know they'd always planning on retiring up to Philo, if you know where Philo is.
I do actually. I've been there. Yeah.
Yeah. The apple farm up there is just extraordinary.
Beautiful.
You know, and they bought that years before they bought the French Laundry. So that was always their goal is to move to Philo and live on the apple farm. And it was time. It was perfect timing for them. It was great timing for me. And I was able to not easily, but over a period of 18 months, you know, cobble together, you know, three sources of investment and purchase the restaurant. In 1994, so May 1st, we closed on the restaurant, and July 6th, 2 days after, you know, our Fourth of July.
Yeah.
I opened the French Laundry.
You know, what's amazing is that I'm glad you said it that way, that Raoul's had Alchemy, and a number of the people that have worked there, some of the maitre d's, thought it was them and didn't realize that it was the restaurant and went on to have difficult times.
Yeah.
The fact that you knew that you were able to identify that this place, the French Laundry, had its own magic to which you could bring your hard work, your consistency, and your sense of excellence and achievement was probably, and I'm saying this out loud for people who are interested in opening a restaurant, that this is years of hard work and the development of certain skills, including the ability to identify magic, alchemy, when it smacks you in the nose. We are talking to Chef Thomas Keller, probably the most decorated, and we're going to talk about that in the next segment, I promise, chef in America. We're going to talk about those restaurants that he has, some of which, are all gathered together in the magical little town of Yountville, California, in just a couple of seconds when we return at the table. We are back at the table. I'm talking to Chef Thomas Keller. He is most famous for the French Laundry, a restaurant that's gotten every star there is from everybody that gives him out in Yountville, California, in the Napa Valley. He has other restaurants. Thomas, welcome back to At the Table. We are talking about your restaurants and the trajectory and all the work you did to get to where you got to go and all the ups and downs. And it sounds like there were some challenges from which you learned a lot. You have, let's see, four, am I getting this right, besides the garden, four going concerns in the town of Yountville?
We do. We have, you know, of course, the French Laundry, which is probably the most recognized. And then we have Bouchon, which is just a lovely French bistro. And next door to Bouchon, we have Bouchon Bakery.
Right.
And then further down the street, we have a restaurant called Ad Hoc. And behind Ad Hoc, by the way, there's a little... A beautiful garden where on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday,
yeah,
we serve fried chicken and barbecue, and that little place is called Addendum.
Oh, wait, Addendum, that's very funny. So explain, I mean, Ad Hoc, you had originally intended the building for something else?
Yeah, the hamburger restaurant that I've been thinking about for the past, now I think, 24 years.
Right.
which never really happened. When we bought Ad Hoc, we didn't buy Ad Hoc because I wanted another restaurant.
Right.
We bought the property because the property has the back garden, which we were going to be able to do our employee housing on for the inn project that we were working on across the street from the French Laundry, which is now our garden.
Got it.
Anyway, long story short, that didn't happen. Ad Hoc did. The hamburger restaurant never did, and Ad Hoc now is... just celebrated its 10th anniversary.
Yeah, you know, Ad Hoc was like, it was kind of one of the original pop-ups.
I mean, kind of, yeah.
Right, right. It's one of my favorite restaurants anywhere. It takes me a minute to get organized to get over there, but because it takes me longer to get from Northwestern Sonoma, you know, to Yountville than it does to get to San Francisco.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And I also, there's a lot of distractions. But Ad Hoc is a place where there's a singular meal every night where it's a prefix number, and it's not a high number. I mean, it's not a low number. It's, you know, it's not a blue plate special, but it's not at the level of other multi-course meals that you serve or that others serve these days. Mm-hmm. And it's served by a lot of really incredibly nice and enthusiastic people who maybe don't want to know the entire history of Pinot Noir, but are really, really happy to share a salad with you.
Yeah.
I mean, I that's my translation.
You know, the intention was, of course, is that, you know, it's like going home, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you didn't have a choice. I don't know about your house, but there was no menu at my house. The food went on the table, and you ate it, or you didn't eat it.
That's right.
No, you know, and so that was, you know, and the wine went on the table. Not that we had wine, but, you know, it's an idea of that communal, that social gathering where, you know, you're not really being, the intention is that you are serving each other.
Right.
As opposed to having a waiter pour your wine or a waiter pouring your water or a waiter putting a plate down in front of you that you eat. I mean, the food comes out family style. The wine gets open and put on the table. And the same as the water or anything. So really, you know, engaging in that social activity of dining together, you know, and bringing people closer was the whole intent.
And it so much works. I mean, at a very high level where there is a lot of choreography, a lot of movement, a lot of almost, I don't know, dance, it's performance, mm-hmm. at the very highest level at your restaurants. I mean, I love that. I love somebody mm-hmm. wordlessly and silently and almost invisibly refilling a glass before I notice it. Mm-hmm. But in a mid-level restaurant, it drives me crazy right. when somebody at a trattoria tries to constantly pour Pellegrino into my glass when it's right there and I can do it. And every time they do it, they're interrupting right. a conversation I'm having with my friend.
Right.
It drives me. So ad hoc has been there 10 years.
10 years.
Did you, I mean, I remember there were some evolution at the beginning. There was some discussion. I mean, how do you deal with the whole vegetable issue and vegans and people who won't eat fish? And I mean, because, you know, Americans are incredibly, what's the word? Oh, yes, picky. And you know, there are all these.
We like to say specific.
Specific, yeah. And I say picky because, you know, I don't have to be as nice as you do at this moment. But well, I should be. All right. What do you do about that? I mean, it seems like, and I could have this wrong, but it seems like there's more traditional protein in the regular menus that you have there than perhaps at the beginning where I had no idea what you were going to serve.
Yeah, you know, we've kind of gotten into this groove. We realized that, you know, I always wanted to have fish on Friday because as I grew up, yep. you know, as a Catholic, you know, every Friday we had fish. And so I thought, wow, this is wonderful. Not to try to make people eat fish on Friday because of any religious beliefs, but just that it was kind of a tradition. We'd have fish on Friday. Well, yep. people would walk up and they'd see the menu and they'd turn around and walk away because they want to have something that they can drink red wine with.
Yeah. So, Napa Valley.
You know, and then you have, you know, is lamb. I mean, there's lamb is always this protein that people struggle with. So you kind of settle into this, you know, pork, chicken, duck, beef, you know, maybe some veal now and then kind of situation where people are comfortable, you know, because they know that they have the reference points to the food and they can drink red wine with it. Now, you know, in any restaurant, I just got to say this, in any restaurant, if you don't eat meat, then ask for a piece of fish. We always have. We're a restaurant.
Got it.
It's not like we don't want to give you what you want. If you're a vegetarian, no problem. I mean, you think it's hard to cook vegetables? Not really.
Not really.
If you're a vegan, no issues. I mean, just make sure you ask. The one thing I do ask everybody who's listening is don't tell me you're allergic to something if you don't like something.
Yeah.
Because then it just creates all kinds of like, oh my God, they're allergic to garlic. What happens if they eat garlic? And at what point can we have garlic? Is the garlic's in the sauce? Are they going to taste the garlic? Is how, you know, just tell me you don't like garlic. And you know, it's not like you're ever going to taste garlic in a fondue because, you know, it's four generations before you get to eat it. So it's just part of the complex flavors of it.
All right. So, and I'm going to, now that you've done your commercial about that, I'm going to do mine. I am deathly allergic to scallops. And I went to Le Grand Vaufort. I took my teenage nieces when they were 16 to Paris. And I'm still paying for it. But all through the week, there were these kind of 16-year-old girls in jeans from Santa Fe, New Mexico. And finally I said, you know, you're going to bring a dress, you're going to comb your hair, you're going to put on a little makeup or eyeliner, a little something. And I'm going to take you to a good restaurant. We went to Le Grand Vaufort in the Palais Royal, and it's from the 1700s. And I said, I ordered this whole meal, and I said to the waiter, I'm very allergic to scallops. I'm very allergic. And I knew, I don't know why I knew, that sometimes in an aspic, particularly when there's lobster, that sometimes scallop juice is used to sweeten it. I'd been going to La Varenne. I'd been teaching at La Varenne, which is a cooking school there. I guess it came up somewhere, and I asked about it, and the man said, no, 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 no. And they brought this little tiny pyramid, little aspic. I mean, it couldn't have been the size of a dime. And it had a little piece of lobster in the center, and the rest was clear. And I ate it, and within 60 seconds, I was in the Palais Royal losing my lunch.
Oh.
Yeah, for 12 hours. Now, mind you, they scarfed down the white Burgundy, the half bottle, and they grabbed the red Burgundy. But Le Grand Vaufort charged for the entire meal.
I will never forget.
Bad. Yeah, yeah. And so it's not that I don't like scallops, French friends.
Right.
It's that they are going to put me in the middle of the street for 12 hours, and it's not going to be pretty. You can go to Ad Hoc. You can go to any one of Chef Thomas Keller's restaurants and ask for what you need and what you like, and just don't pretend that you're gluten-free while you're eating a muffin. All right, we're going to be back in just a moment. We will continue the walk through Yountville with Chef Thomas Keller right here at the table. Welcome back to At the Table. I'm talking to Chef Thomas Keller, and we're kind of going very slowly through the town of Yountville, which is not easy to do because it's tiny. It's a couple of blocks that got to be kind of a goofy 70s town with a semi-unfortunate caboose-based shopping center, and that has evolved to one of the leading culinary capitals in the world. I mean, really, and it's all thanks to you.
It's funny, isn't it?
Right. I remember when I was working at the Oakville Grocery, when I, in 1979, got to the town of Oakville, just above where you are in Yountville, and saw this old Coca-Cola ad painted on the side of this 1930s general store, and I thought, whoa, this is a life-changing moment. I get it. And, you know, we would go to Yountville, you know, for giggles, because it was the closest little town around. There were more than two buildings, for one thing. You know, from Oakville, that was a big deal. And there were some things there. People were trying to make an effort, and it was sweet, and it was surrounded by wine country. But the French Laundry had been this, well, had been a French Laundry, and then it became the French Laundry restaurant. And then you kept updating it. And every time you'd redo the restaurant and spend months doing it, there would be the same 72 seats, but a better kitchen. And then the
actually 62 seats, but a better kitchen. But,
all right, 62.
Or a better office, or a better wine cellar, or a better garden, or
yeah,
whatever. Yeah,
right. Is you know you did what the French do, which is to reinvest in what's there as opposed to gutting and starting from scratch.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so for people who don't know, Bouchon for me is it's kind of a brasserie with bistro food. I don't know how else to say that. It because brasseries tend to be glitzy and grand cafes, and some of your bouchons are pretty big and pretty sparkly, but the food is very grounded, and it's very warming and very familiar and very comforting, and I mean meticulously done. But what drives me crazy is I think that one of the great things about professional cooking is when you take a lot of different methodologies, a lot of different processes, a lot of different efforts, and at the end the customer, the guest, has a simple emotional experience from your complicated hard work.
You know, what we try to do at Bouchon is it's a bistro, and we want to really respect the history of the French cuisine as it's presented in a bistro. You know, so it's a very simple menu, and you have, you know, the same proteins throughout the year. Certainly our garnishes change because the vegetables change throughout the year. But, you know, we want to make the best roasted chicken that we can, or the best roasted leg of lamb, or the best trout Normandine. We're not trying to reinvent what a bistro is. We're not trying to, like, add our little signature to it. You know, we know that we can cook au banquet de veau better than they could 50 years ago or 100 years ago. And why can't we do that? We can do that because we have better products today.
Yeah.
We have better tools today.
Yeah.
We have better skills today.
Yeah.
But it's still a banquet de veau as it was made 100 years ago. We just know how to make it better. And that's what we want to do. We don't want to interpret anything. We want to be true to the history and the classics of French bistro.
Well, and Bouchon, particularly in the Napa Valley, is just such a classic spot. I've had the pleasure of spending a New Year's Eve sitting at the bar with a friend and having steak frites. And everything about it was both transporting to a kind of Parisian countryside and placemaking, because obviously the wines were from down the road and from the local fruit.
Right.
So, and in each of the restaurants that you have, how do you deal with it, the question of price and value? I mean, again, some of it is for the cost of goods, and then you mark it up and do all those things that the industry does. But do you, in each of the levels, do you say, look, we want to give people an experience that is at this level, and that's what it costs?
Yeah, well, so we can talk about a couple of things there, because standards, you know, let's just talk about standards.
Yep.
The standards at the French Laundry are the same standards at Bouchon, the same standards at Bouchon Bakery, and the same standards at Ad Hoc. The standards that we have nothing to do with price or cost. They're just our standards, you know. So, you know, the price variation has to do with the products that we get, and they're not any less quality products. We'll use the leg of lamb at Bouchon, for example. We'll use the rack of lamb here at the French Laundry.
Yeah.
But we would use the leg of lamb at Bouchon and the shoulder of lamb at Ad Hoc.
Ad Hoc.
So you can see it all comes from the same lamb. So the quality of the lamb is the same. You know, our kitchens and our restaurants are built to specifications on what we feel is an environment that is conducive to good work habits and evolution in those habits, and giving those individuals in the restaurant the right environment to work in. So that's really, really critical to us in all of our restaurants. The value thing really comes into, you know, it's such a personal thing to talk about, and we struggle with it all the time, you know, especially at a restaurant like the French Laundry, where, you know, it's a very expensive meal. But
right.
if I raise the price by $5 tomorrow, it's not like people aren't going to come. I mean, you know, if they're going to spend the amount of money they're spending today,
right,
add $5 or add even $10 to it, and they're still going to come. So
right.
It really falls on our shoulders, right? And we need to be really responsible with addressing, you know, the price value. And we want to give an experience to our guests that when they leave the restaurant, they're not thinking about how much it costs. They're thinking about this wonderful experience, and it becomes a memory. And a wonderful memory, as you know, is priceless.
Yeah.
How can you put a value? How can you put a price
you've said a couple of things that are kind of wonderful.
Yeah.
My fondest meals, and I've had a number of meals at the French Laundry, were a couple of lunches that I had by myself where I spent several hours just luxuriating in the opportunity to have that kind of food served in that kind of environment at that level. And I loved what you said about your standards being your standards, because if people understand that Ad Hoc may be a more casual restaurant, but it's Thomas Keller doing a casual restaurant. It's Thomas Keller and his group doing a bistro in a classic environment, or making a roll or a baguette for a bakery. And you've done this also at Bouchon Bakery in New York City,
mm-hmm.
and at what I used to call the Samsung Cafe. All right, look, we have to go. We have one more segment. And in that segment, we're going to talk about the future and the mentors the mentorship that you're providing. When we come
Thank
back
you.
At the table. We are back at the table with Chef Thomas Keller for the last 3 minutes and 40 seconds of chat here at the table. Chef, you talk about all these different restaurants that you have, and quite frankly, in order to be able to be successful at all, there's an enormous pressure to size up so that you can have enough to have the economies of scale to purchase, as you say, the whole animal to use in all the different places, to keep your staff interested, because it's one of the hardest things to really bring people along. You've been very involved in mentorship program. Tell us about that.
Well, I mean, what we want to do, so here's the basic, you know, and I can't get any basic of this. So there's three steps in this process, right? So first is hiring somebody, right? And that's we don't want to take that for granted. We want to make sure that we're hiring the right individuals. We want to make sure that they feel themselves that they can be successful in our organization. So taking the time to hire the right person is critical, whether in the kitchen, the dining room, the wine team, wherever. I mean, and it's not just let's hire this person. We need a person to fill a space. That's not it. You have to hire the right people and then train them. And training, when I was growing up in the profession, we were trained for 2 weeks. It's like, here you go, you're done, 2 weeks over, you're done.
Right.
And it's like, really? I mean, so like, you know, mothers and fathers out there who have children, you know, and they're teaching them to swim and they put the floaties on the arms, they say, you have 2 weeks to learn how to swim, and then they take the floaties off, the poor kid drowns, and they say, it's your fault.
Yeah,
like, you know, it's like, it doesn't work. 2 weeks just doesn't work for some people.
It's not enough.
It's not enough. It's like, you got to train them until they feel confident that they can do it, and you have to be there with them, and you have to be paying attention to them, and you have to give them what they need.
Well, and besides knife skills and all the rest of it, I mean, there are a lot of food and ingredient origin and historical things that are, I mean, how do you give them that in a restaurant environment while you're
it takes a long time. It takes an army. It takes everybody. It's not just the sous chefs, it's your colleagues, it's everybody in the restaurant. I mean, we have to be committed 100% after you hire the person. You're committed 100%, not 95, not 90%, 100% to that person's success.
Yeah.
And you're going to do everything you can to make that person successful. And then what happens after that? Then you mentor them, right? And training goes on for a long time. I mean, you know, it really never stops. And then mentorship, right? What is mentorship? Mentorship is helping guide, you know, a young professional in their career, but also a little bit, you know, in their personal life, right? So mentorship is really important.
These are, in other words, these are human beings. They're not just filling a spot. I mean, you know, I can't tell you, you know, you get all wound up when you talk about this.
Yeah.
And I like that, because so do I, because these are the things that are important. You know, this is one of those moments where I really wish that this was longer than an hour show. We're going to have you back to continue this conversation, because as we're leaving the table in the last 30 seconds, you support support your chefs all over the country, even after they've graduated from working with you. You find places for them in your organization. And give me a 10-second about the Bocuse d'Or.
Well, you know, the Bocuse d'Or is your U.S. culinary team. I can only say that they represent the entire population of America. They're doing an extraordinary job. We brought home silver in 2015, the first time in 28 years since the competition began.
Right.
The U.S. was even on the podium.
All right. So listen, next year it's going to be gold. We're going to come back and talk to Thomas Keller really soon. Thank you so much, Chef, for being with us here at the
table.
Thank
you. Thank you.